And the reason I suggest that is that longer chiastic outline of the overall structure, if you have last night's sheets open to that place as you look at the outline this morning, the microstructure may be helpful to have both before you. And your Bible open, beginning at chapter 1, verse 1. I'll make only a few comments here about the title. The Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim in Hebrew, is a Hebrew construct superlative. It's like Kodesh Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, or the most sublime song. The construct means it's the best or the highest song. And the infinitive to Solomon, I want to observe, is reflected in 6:13 in the only place where the female protagonist is named the Shulamite. And I want you to note that the Shulamite is the feminine form of Solomon. So in the names that are here in the poem, we have the reciprocity of the individuals in their own Hebrew determinations. Now, the first section of the microstructure of this poem is the prologue in verse 2 of chapter 1, extending through verse 7 of chapter 2. And we want to ask as we begin what a prologue does. There are prologues to each of the four Gospels. The most famous, of course, the first 18 verses of chapter 1 of the fourth Gospel, John's magnificent prologue. But in fact, Matthew, Mark, and Luke also have prologues. This is a prologue in poetic form here in the Song of Solomon. A prologue introduces a work, and in this case, we learn who the main characters of our poem are, the dramatis personae, the persons of the drama. The main male and female characters come to our attention immediately in this prologue, but there are some minor characters whom we meet in this first and second chapter. The daughters of Jerusalem are introduced in verse 5 of chapter 1, her mother, the female's mother, in verse 6 of chapter 1, her brothers in verse 6 of chapter 1, his companions, that is Solomon's companions, in verses 7 and 8. We are not introduced to the watchmen who appear in chapter 3 and in chapter 5, nor are we introduced to Solomon's mother, who appears in verse 11 of chapter 3. But nonetheless, the main characters are introduced in the prologue. Second of all, the prologue sets the tone. It sets the mood of the work as a whole. I described that last night in terms of Leitwörter, the key word, which in Hebrew is ahav, love, occurs seven times in this prologue, verses 3, 4, and 7 in chapter 1, verses 4, 5, and 7 in chapter 2. Now, the prologue also suggests the dominant imagery. The sensuous or sense imagery begins to be drawn out of this opening section. For instance, touch. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, verse 2 of chapter 1. Verse 6 of chapter 2, let his left hand be under my head, his right hand embrace me. The touch of embrace. Smell is present in chapter 1, verse 2. We smell oils or perfumes, sweet savors. Verses 2, 12, and 13 all are appealing to our sense of smell. Our tastes are aroused in this section of the prologue. Verse 3 and 5 of chapter 2, the apples are referred to, the raisins in verse 5, the fruit in general in verse 3 of chapter 2. Our taste buds are sensing wonderful experiences. The sound of sheep and goats in verses 7 and 8. Now, chapter 1, we hear the bleating of the sheep and the lambs. And finally, our eyes behold a lovely, beautiful people, a lovely girl, verse 5, a handsome man, verse 16 of chapter 1. In fact, she's so conscious of being stared at in verse 6 of chapter 1 that she asks that the gaze be turned aside. The characters, the mood, the sensuous imagery, and finally, the point of the prologue, setting the tone of the book to draw us into the drama of the story, to make us participants even as we read this introductory prologue. Now, the drama of this prologue moves by way of dialogue. There is a exchange of conversation between the main characters, the male and the female. And in your outline of the microstructure, I've given you a way of filling in the blanks on the dialogic chiasm. Now, I mean that by dialogic that there is a discussion going back and forth, and this dialogue has a chiastic structure. That is, it's patterned in reciprocal or parallel fashion. For instance, in verses 2 to 7, the female is the speaker. So you might want to write in on the blank, she speaks. And she is answered in verse 9 to 11 for sure, perhaps verse 8. Verse 8 is a little bit difficult. She is answered by the male, so he speaks. And then she speaks in verses 12 to 14. He speaks at the center of the chiasm in verse 15. She speaks in 16 to 2:1. He speaks in 2:2. And she speaks again in verses 3 to 7 of chapter 2. This dialogic chiasm, as you will notice, if you would draw a line from A to A prime, from B to B prime, C to C prime, you draw a straight line down your page at those points. This dialogic chiasm is a reciprocal balance. Every place she speaks, he answers. Every place he speaks, she answers. He is at the center. He becomes, shall we say, the glue to the dialogue. But let's notice how she begins. She begins and ends the chiasm with an expression of her desire. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, verse 2. She ends in verse 6 of chapter 2, let his right hand embrace me. So she is describing her desires at the beginning and end of this dialogic exchange. He assures her, in response to her desire, he assures her that she is his darling. Verse 9 of chapter 1 and verse 2 of chapter 2. At each point where he reciprocates, she is his darling. Her response to his description of her as his darling is that she describes him as her beloved. Verse 13 of chapter 1 and verse 16 of chapter 1 again. Now that brings us to the hinge. That brings us to the center of the chiasm, which is verse 15. And this verse is an expression from him to her that she is doubly beautiful. Doubly beautiful. And her fetching eyes, which are soft, gentle, they are cooing to him like doves. Notice the plural. Doves, plural. Her eyes, which are plural, she has two of them, are like doves, plural, doubly enforcing his desire reciprocally for her. So even the vocabulary he uses at the center of the chiasm is intended to double his sense of delight in her. He is mirroring her expressions. The point is that the mutuality of this matched pair in this dialogic discussion, this chiastic dialogue, is a complementarity of their male-female love. They talk to one another in this dialogue, and that's what all lovers do. They communicate verbally. They listen to one another because they respond as they talk to one another, as all lovers do. All good lovers are good listeners. They affect one another. That is, these lovers are affectionate to one another, and here they are affectionate verbally to one another in this dialogue. And all good lovers respond to one another. These lovers mutually, reciprocally respond to one another. When she first speaks in verses 2-7, her desire for his kisses is evident, but also evident is her hesitancy, her self-doubt, how she sees herself, dark, not like the sheltered complexions of the city or palace maidens. She's had to work in the fields. His reply to her in verses 9-11 is a description of how he sees her. He sees her as elegant and beautiful. He doesn't see her as she sees herself. He sees her as the lovely one. That comment then causes her to describe him with exuberance, verses 12-14. She's being drawn to him in excitement because of the way he sees her. He reinforces his view of her in verse 15, doubly reinforces his delight in her beauty. Twice he tells her she is beautiful. She responds in verse 16 through verse 1 of chapter 2 by telling him he is handsome, but she herself is somewhat insignificant as a small flower. He quickly extols her as singularly beautiful, one who stands out in his eyes, verse 2 of chapter 2, and that comment produces her most exuberant description of him, verses 3-7 of chapter 2, and her desire for him, verse 6. Now, a few miscellaneous comments. First of all, on verse 5, she says that she is black or dark, but lovely. The black or darkness is defined from the fact that she'd been left out in the field, where she had been a caretaker in the vineyards because her brothers had left them. She's been sunburned. She's become swarthy in complexion. But you will notice that the dark but lovely, the similes there, the double similes, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, that those similes are parallel to the darkness. Dark but lovely, dark like the tents of Kedar, dark but lovely like the curtains of Solomon. So both of those similes are related to her description of herself as dark in complexion. And those similes are indicative of, although she is dark in complexion, she is shimmering in her beauty in that darkness, like the tents of Kedar shimmering in the distance, like the beautiful velvet curtains of Solomon's palace shimmering upon the wall. This intensifies her loveliness. The fact that she says it twice is to heighten the sense of her own beauty. Now, in verse 9, he says that she's a mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. Now, if any of you called your sweethearts or your wife a mare among the chariots of Pharaoh, they'd probably kick you out of bed or throw you out of the house. It does not sound like a compliment. And yet, if you understand why he says it, you understand what the point of it is. This is his pet name for her. It's like W.C. Fields, you know, my little chickadee. Every group of lovers has pet names. And this pet name is that she is like a mare from Pharaoh's stable. Now, why does it say Pharaoh's stable? Because the Egyptian horses were the prize horses of the ancient world. So she is a prize, like the mare in Pharaoh's stable. But she is also a prize who excites him. Think about it. You put a mare in a stable with the stallions, and they're going to move around. In fact, they're going to start to kick down the doors. So, this is the point of the image. The image is that he sees her as one who is prized, beautiful, for her loveliness, but she also excites him. Now, the last desultory comment here is in verse 6 of chapter 2, when she says, "Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me." There is only one way that she could achieve that, and that is if they were laying down. Now, the prologue has told us how our lovers see one another, how she sees herself as she mirrors him, and as he sees himself and her as he reflects upon her. This section is a mutual awakening of love. Love in its youth, as I suggested last night. Perhaps a courtship. Perhaps they are dating, as we would say it today. But if there is more, if there's more than prenuptial yearning here, if in fact there is fruition or consummation in this section, particularly in verse 6 of chapter 2, if that is the case, then it transforms this prologue into a telescopic device. It makes the prologue what all of you moviegoers know every film director uses. It makes the prologue a flashback device. Namely, she is casting back over the history of the relationship, and she is looking at it from the beginning to its consummation. If there is consummation, then in verse 6 of chapter 2, it's not because they are premaritally engaged, illicitly. No. It is because she is looking at the whole range of the relationship as she journals it in her memory. And she's journaling it from the standpoint of being on the other side of the marriage. Now that brings us to the second section, the invitation in chapter 2, verses 8 to 17, where we move to multiple inclusios, and we move to a shift in scene, and we move by way of transition. You will notice verse 7, where she asks the daughters of Jerusalem not to awaken love until it pleases. And verse 8, "Listen, my beloved, behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. Do not awaken love. Listen, my beloved is coming. Love has been awakened." So we've transitioned from "do not awaken love" to "love is awake" in verse 8. In other words, there are a number of indications that when we come to verse 8 of chapter 2, we have moved over into a new unit, a new section of the poem. I pointed some of those out last night. I want you also to note the first major inclusio, which brackets this unit. In verse 8 of chapter 2, she says, "my beloved." In verse 16 of chapter, in verse 17 of chapter 2, she says, verse 16, she says, "my beloved," in 17 as well. So that at the beginning and end of this section, we have a term of endearment where she describes him as her beloved, and that brackets the unit, that sets off this section of the poem. Now we also have a further support of this unit, 2:8 to 17, in verses 8 and 9 and 17 detail. You have a larger bracket for the second multiple inclusio, which has a number of lines opposite 2, 9, 8, and 2, 17. And here's what I want you to notice. In verse 9, we have the mention of the gazelle. In verse 17, we have the mention of the gazelle again. In verse 9, we have the mention of the young stag. In verse 17, we have the mention of the young stag again. And finally, in verse 8, we have the mention of the mountains. And in verse 17, we have the mention of the mountain again. The inclusios, both the broad one, my beloved, and these more specific ones using the flora and fauna imagery, so to speak, are enclosing this unit. They are setting it off. They are marking it off as a distinct unit in itself. And finally, there's one more inclusio here, and it's the inclusio of speaker. In verses 8 and 9, she is the speaker. In verses 10 to 14, or perhaps 15, he is the speaker. And in verses 16 and 17, she is the speaker. So you have an inclusio of speaker with him again at the center. Notice how he is the glue at the center of the sections of the poem. Now, as we look at this unit, 8 to 17, chapter 2, the mood of this section is excitement. It is evident in the use of the participles. Participles suggest intense movement. You will see it in verse 8. Coming, climbing, leaping. You will see it again in verse 9. Standing, looking, peering. Now, this excitement, which is reflected in the grammar, the participial terms, this excitement is frustrated. It is frustrated by remoteness. In verse 9, he is at the door. She is inside. He's outside the door. He's slightly removed. In verse 14 of chapter 2, she is like a dove. Remember, he called her a dove at the center of the dialogic chiasm in chapter 1, verse 15. She is like a dove again here in chapter 2, but now she is a dove, as it were, hidden in the clefts of the rock. She is remote. She is distant. Both of them are slightly frustrated at this section of the poem by a remoteness or distance in their relationship. Now, I point out a couple of other interesting structural patterns. You will notice the duplicate behold plus a participle in verse 8. Behold, he is coming. And you will see that again in verse 9. Behold, he is standing. The excitement of expectation, he is coming. The excitement of arrival, he is here. He is just outside the door. And then he responds. All of this inclusio surrounds his response at the center of this section of the poem, verses 10 to 14 for sure, perhaps verse 15. But the inclusio brackets or envelopes his invitation. Arise, my darling, verse 10, my beautiful one, and come along. And then he says it again in verse 13, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. So at the center of the heart of this part of the narrative, of the poem, is his duplicating, his inclusio of invitation, arise, my darling, and come along. Now notice, he doubles the terms of endearment. He says, my darling, twice. What had she called him twice in verses 8 and 9? She had called him her beloved. Two times he is her beloved, two times she is his darling. They match reciprocally perfectly. His excitement mirrors her excitement. You will notice the imperatives that he uses. Arise. Come. He is eager to have her come out to him, to join him where? In the springtime garden-like setting. Why? Verse 11, because or for the winter is past. Spring has sprung, and in the spring, a young man's fancy turns to dot, dot, dot. This is a poem of the earth awakening in springtime. This is a paradise-like description of the earth breaking forth in rebirth. This is a virtual new creation in the springtime setting. He's inviting her to join him in a new world. The winter is past. The rains are over. You know that this was not written in Seattle. In San Diego County, where I used to live, yes. Because San Diego is on the same latitude as Palestine. But the rains are over. And that means that spring has sprung. And all the beauteous sights of spring, which are present in the spring of Palestine, blooming flowers, ripening vines, figs beginning to develop, the lovely sounds of spring, the voice of the turtle dove he describes, the delicate smells that waft in the air in the spring, the fragrance of flowers, vines, and figs, all of these are suggesting a new creation beckoning to this man and this woman. This new creation inviting them to participate, to taste and smell, to see and touch, to hear and understand. It's like Eden reborn here in verses 10 to 14. It's like the springtime of the Garden of Eden, where a man and a woman once upon a time enjoyed one another with delight and passion. He is inviting her to join him in a love of delight and passion, as it were, in a new Eden, as it were, in a new creation. And so in this section of the Song of Solomon, we are reminded of an eschatological Eden. We are reminded of a heavenly garden. We are reminded of a place where it is, shall we say, eternal spring, because all is loveliness and beauty forevermore. Well, even as he yearns for her, her form is hidden from him, occluded by the clefts of the rock in verse 14. And like her intermittently remote form, her voice is silent. It is far off and remote from his eager ears. And so he pleads, let me see your form, let me hear your voice. And then the enigmatic verse 15 of chapter 2, you'll have to come back tomorrow night and hear me preach on it if you want to hear what I have to say in full about that passage. That's an open invitation. But at any rate, at this point, something is continuing to frustrate their relationship in verse 15, so that by the time we arrive at verse 16, and she declares, my beloved is mine and I am his, whatever barriers there are, whatever frustrations have arisen, those barriers and frustrations have been overcome. They are close to one another. Again, I am his, he is mine, and that tension has been resolved. Now in verse 17, you have the enigmatic name of Bether, if it is a proper noun, or a rugged mountain, if it is an adjective. Nobody really knows what it is, so take your pick as to how you want to translate Bether in verse 17. What has happened between the prologue and this first invitation? Well, we've had a development. We've had a development from that scene, the first scene in the prologue. This section, this invitation section, is a mutual excitement section, a heightened eagerness section, a love in bloom session, even as spring blooms, an awakening of love's excitement. We've had mutual sweet talk in this section. Declarations of affection for one another, heaped upon one another, doubling one another. We've had obstacles to their love in this section. Barriers which prevent their togetherness. Barriers which prevent their intimacy. So as the prologue suggests, tentativeness, uncertainty, some self-doubt. The tension in scene two is remoteness, inaccessibility, flanked by eager yearnings and eager longings. Now, that brings us to the next section in chapter 3, verse 1, the nighttime scene. But before I go on with an analysis of that narrative chiasm, let me pause and ask if you have any questions on the first two scenes, the first two units, anything that's not clear to you or anything that you would like to have further explained or developed. Okay, in 2:8 and 2:17, you should have my beloved. Any other questions about the fill in the blank outline? Well, first of all, the question is, the Scofield Bible suggests that the Rose of Sharon in 2:1 refers to the Savior. And what do I think about that? And I don't think very much about that, which is one of the reasons I don't think a whole lot about annotated Bibles. I know that's almost heretical to say in this day and age because everyone wants a study Bible that tells you what it means. But if you want a Bible, get a Bible just to read it. If you want something to study, get commentaries, dictionaries, and other things. Then start studying. But at any rate, that point aside, you gave me the chance to, you know, go beyond. So I took advantage of that. I think, number one, that what's wrong with that suggestion is, first of all, it's the female who's speaking in 2:1. It's not a male figure. Okay. Number two, the word rose is mistranslated. And I'll talk about that tomorrow night. So again, you'll have to come back tomorrow night if you want to hear more detail. Number three, it's not that I don't believe that Christ is behind the book or that there's a Christocentric dimension or Christ-centered dimension to the book. I don't think it flows out of this verse particularly. I think it flows out of the broader relationship between the two lovers. So in other words, I do believe that Christ is revealed in and through the book, but I don't think he's necessarily revealed in and through this verse. Okay, notice that he says, arise, my darling, and come along. Okay, so he is using a vocabulary which is not the vocabulary that she used. She calls him her beloved. That's her vocabulary. He calls her his darling. That's his vocabulary. And if you trace that form through the book, you will find that it's uniformly that way. Beloved is her term. Darling is his term. Now, also in verse 14, when he says, when he uses the word dove again, it's building upon the fact that he described her eyes as doves in verse 15 of chapter 1. And when he says, let me see your form, or let me see your appearance, it is something that he has described in the prologue again. He's talked about how she appears to him as one of great delight. So here he's building upon that emphasis. So once again, I think it's the male figure in those in-between sections of chapter 2. Some of you may have a New American Standard in which the margin switches back and forth between the bride and the bridegroom. In general, those identifications are correct, in my opinion, in general. I think that is, yes, the question is in verse 6 of chapter 2, and my suggestion of an early consummation or a consummation after the marriage, is it a premarital consummation? That would not be consistent with the biblical ethic. So Glickman's Song for Lovers InterVarsity Commentary on this book, which unfortunately is out of print, but is a very good book in general. Glickman's suggestion is that is a yearning desire. Oh, that he were to me like this, all right? So she's anticipating the marriage consummation. Right? She hasn't actually experienced it. My suggestion here is that this is a description of the experience of consummation, and I'm suggesting that because I believe that you have a telescoping device throughout the poem. She goes back and forth in the history of the relationship at various points. And so it's as if she's writing this out of her journal of the whole history of the relationship. How it began, how it matured, how it went through periods of tension, how it was resolved, how it was consummated. I believe that there's more of an overall dramatic flavor to it than simply a yearning. Though, I would defend Glickman's exegesis there because it's consistent with the biblical ethic, though I don't think that it's out of step or it's wrong to say that she's actually achieved consummation here in verse 6 of chapter 2 if you understand that it is a telescoping device. That consummation was after the wedding night. So either way it could go and preserve the sacredness of the biblical ethic. There is a lovers apart, lovers yearning. The question was, does the book in each of its sections recapitulate itself or move through a kind of development to maturity and consummation phase? Yes, there's a sense in which that's true. If you look at my broader chiastic outline, I show you those patterns or paradigms, which are lovers apart, lovers together, and lovers yearning or reunited. So that flows through each one. Though, as we demonstrated last night, there is a development at the antipodes of the chiasm, the A prime, B, B prime, C, C prime, and the center at the D hinge point. All right. Beloved is different from love. It's a different Hebrew root. Okay, the word love and its verb to love is from the Hebrew ahav. The word beloved here is the word dodi or doda. It's a different, entirely different Hebrew word. So even though they're in the realm of the emotion of love, they are a different root, so they don't repeat themselves. So what I'm looking for when I'm looking for these inclusios, I'm looking for the very same Hebrew word. So when I say that I've got an inclusio here or multiple inclusios, those inclusios are based on the Hebrew text. I'm using the English translation so that you see it, but you wouldn't understand a whole lot of it if I were speaking out of the Hebrew. But my inclusios are based on the original text. So you may have some variation in English translation, as you have love and lover or beloved sounds similar, but they're actually two different Hebrew words. The question was, what was the function of the Song of Solomon? Keep me honest here, okay. What was the function of the Song of Solomon as it was read or as it was used in worship or the liturgy of Israel? It's one of the Megillot, that is the sacred writings, and each one of the sacred writings is read at a particular time of the year. And the Song of Solomon, if my memory serves me correctly, the Song of Solomon was read at Pentecost. Now, why would you read the Song of Solomon at Pentecost? Well, because Pentecost, of course, is the first fruits. It's the offering of the first fruits of the harvest. And you would be celebrating God's blessing or benediction to the land, so to speak. So you'd be reminded of that blessing or benediction on the fruitfulness of love, namely marriage. So the two do somewhat line up with one another. But setting aside the Jewish custom of reading it there, what would a Jewish person hearing this hear? They would hear the chiasm. They would hear the reinforcement of the duplicate patterns. They were trained to hear that. That's one of the ways they remembered things. That's one of the ways they learned. That's one of the ways in a non-literate culture, and I don't mean that they couldn't read, but they didn't have a lot of written material. That's what I mean by that. In a non-literate culture, in an oral culture, A-U-R-A-L, in an oral culture, they had to listen. They had to listen for these markers. They had to listen for these keys. So, in this section, verse 8, where she sees and somebody, some Hebrew cantor is saying, Dodi, which means my beloved. And at the end of verse 17, Dodi, which means my beloved. The Hebrew listener says, oh, we just had a unit. We just had a section. And you see, they begin to key in, to clue in to what's going on between those markers. Now, I can't completely describe the psychology of a Hebrew hearing this and listening to it. But my point is, I'm attempting to reconstruct some of the drama that they sensed as they heard it read in Hebrew, or as they read it in Hebrew when it was actually inscripturated. I think they would have perceived it in a sensuous... The question was, would they have perceived it in a sensuous or sensual way? I'll take that part second, and then I kind of evaded, and he's right, he caught me here. I did kind of evaded the emotion of this second section, or the how they would hear it with their feelings. My case is, I believe, if they heard it properly, if they heard it believing, they heard it as a reflection of God's marriage to his people. That's how they heard it. And in Solomon and his Shulamite, they were hearing a specific revelation or description of that. Now, with respect to hearing it sensuously, I believe that they did hear it that way, and that they did not take it sensually, because covenant community understood the boundaries of that type of thing. But there is erotic love poetry from the ancient Near East. There's tons of it, and it is ugly stuff. And the Song of Solomon, in comparison with that, stands head and shoulders above it. In other words, it is virtually unparalleled. Even Michael Fox, the famous Hebraist from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, even Michael Fox has written a commentary on this. I don't recommend his commentary. But even Michael Fox, who reads Egyptian hieroglyphics, who reads Akkadian, who reads Sumerian, even Michael Fox, who wants to make the Song of Solomon another ancient Near Eastern erotic poem, even Michael Fox admits it's different. It's not like the pornography of the ancient Near East. It's unique. There is a delicacy here. There is a refinement here. There is a beauty here that you will not find in any other erotic literature. And I think that's the reason it's a damnable sin to say that Song of Solomon is biblical pornography. And believe me, there are lots of liberals out there who are saying that about this book. In fact, there's a major commentary on this book that comes from that perspective, and it's by Marvin Pope in the Anchor Bible Commentary Series. You learn more about ancient Near Eastern pornography in that book than you learn about the Song of Solomon, which means you're learning more about Marvin Pope than you're learning about Solomon. The comment is, he sees an equality of the sexes. I got that one right. He sees an equality of the sexes here in the Song of Solomon, and I trust that I've underscored my agreement with that observation, namely that there is a reciprocal complementarity here between the male and the female. Now, we haven't asked the question about role distinctions, but we're talking about equality in terms of how they stand before God, how they stand before one another. How they stand in other words, in the marriage relationship as complements of one another, reciprocally complementary. And that is as it was in the beginning, isn't it? Is that not so? As Matthew Henry pointed out so many years ago, the woman was made not from man's head to rule over him, or from his feet to be stamped upon by him, but she was taken from his side to stand beside him. Now, in saying that, I am not denying the distinctions in roles that come in male headship in the church and the home. I think that's a biblical theological paradigm as well, but I'm here this weekend to talk about the Song of Solomon, not to talk about Paul's concept of headship and redemptive historical recapitulation. If you want that, you have to come back some other time, take a class. I just did that this week in the New Testament introduction when we talked about the book of Romans and 1 Corinthians 15. anyway, that's a paid announcement. But I'm not gonna get into that side. The observation of their mutuality, complementarity, reciprocity, I think that stands out very strongly from this book. She's asking a question about the history of interpretation. Is the way Dennison is interpreting the book the way the church has interpreted the book down through history? Yes and no. Mostly no. And the reason for that is that the church has had a great difficulty with allegorizing this book, attempting to try to find some kind of mystical meaning in it. I think the church has had the right idea there. I just don't think she's ended up in the right place. And she hasn't ended up in the right place from the right exegetical point of view. What I'm dealing with here, as you're seeing, is I'm working out of the Hebrew text in, shall we say, a structural or narrative critical approach. I don't mean higher critical, but what I'm doing is I'm looking at the Hebrew text, I'm attempting to deal with the text, and to my knowledge, the church has not done this. In fact, David Dorsey, whom I cite in my bibliography, is the first person to touch the key to the Song of Solomon in this way. Now, that does not mean that the church hasn't seen truths in the book in its previous history, but I do believe that the development of, shall we say, narrative poetics, which is a development of the last 20 years in Old and New Testament studies, that has had tremendous impact and influence on our understanding, perhaps for the first time clearly. That doesn't mean that they haven't understood it at all in the previous history of the church, but for the first time clearly understanding what this book is all about. I think I've been able last night to persuade you, well, perhaps not persuade you, but to tell you that this book has a redemptive historical position. And that, I think, is also new because I think it solves the whole allegorical conundrum. So are there elements of my suggestions in Bernard of Clairvaux, for instance, in Origen, for instance? Yes, there are elements, there are hints, there are suggestions. But as Origen or Bernard of Clairvaux or Calvin or anyone else approaching the book the way I am, no. Because they don't approach the Hebrew text the way I'm doing it. And I think the key to this book is the Hebrew text, the way it's been inspired, the way it's been laid down by the Holy Spirit. That's the reason the Hebrew structure is the center of my case. If you're going to demolish my case, you're going to have to pick me apart on the basis of the Hebrew structure of the book. That, I think, is new and refreshing and stimulating, which just reminds us of John Robinson, that old Puritan pastor who sent the pilgrims over to America, said as he left them on the harbor at Delfthaven in Holland, as John Robinson said to those pilgrims before he sent them to England and they came to Massachusetts Bay, as John Robinson said, God hath yet more light to break forth out of his word. Nobody's had the last word. Dennison hasn't had the last word on the Song of Solomon. Nobody will have the last word until Jesus comes. So if you think everything's been said about any particular part of Scripture, I'm saying today you got another thing coming. Until Jesus comes, there's more light to break forth. I didn't say more revelation. I said more light on the revelation that is there. We're not at the end of understanding the depths and riches of the Word of God. I made a comment about the eschatological Eden, and as it were, springtime or Eden reborn in chapter 2, verses 10 to 14. The imagery there is the imagery of a garden anew in the spring, of the winter being past and it's blooming and springing up, very much like the Garden of Eden in the beginning. So what I'm saying is that the imagery there reminds us of imagery back in Genesis 2 and 3. And that imagery is also projected into Revelation 19 to 22, so it has an eschatological vector as well as a protological vector. So when I come to that imagery here in this book, I see that it is connected. It's connected backwards to Eden. It's connected forwards to the eschatological Eden, the heavenly Eden. And therefore, I want to place this in part in relationship to those two vectors, to those two dimensions. The question is, are the barriers here in the Song of Solomon reflected in the tensions that we sense because we're not united to Christ? Yes, because the love that you have with your Savior is not a consummated, eternal, perfect love. And so there will be a sense in which, even as in your marriage, you sense some barriers and frustrations, which reminds you that you're still in an era under the curse. Nonetheless, in part, you've been delivered from that, so you're hungering and longing and yearning for that, for the perfect, which is yet to come, all right? But you haven't got there yet. So the reflection between the human intimacy and the spiritual intimacy is reflected reciprocally as well. You're welcome.